Thank you for attending the last of our concurrent Thursday presentations. This is session 177, titled Finding Spiritual Paths After Mormonism. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you are taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books. Please support Mormon studies by supporting our vendors. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework of that time so we can end on time. That's a lot of saying time. Please make sure to pick up your belongings as you leave, and we look forward to seeing you bright and early tomorrow. Each morning, the first 50 attendees get a doorbuster prize, so get here early. Okay, about this presentation. Though some leave the faith of their fathers, they still continue to seek truth and knowledge. This panel will explore how different individuals of the Mormon spectrum have connected with their own spirituality post-Mormonism. Roman Bateman was born and raised in the largest polygamous group in North America, the FLDS. He was pulled out of third grade to work, apostatized when he was 16, and wandered through his own wilderness. He is now a Utah artist. Vance Blackmore was born and raised in a fundamentalist sect in Canada, where he grew up in the logging industry. He has since left the group to find his own path as a spiritualist, mystic, and seeker. Alyssa Wall is a former member of the FLDS Church who was forced into marriage at age 14. She left the FLDS at age 18 and began the difficult journey to freedom. Alyssa is now a thriving entrepreneur, author, speaker, and advocate. She lives in southern Utah with her two children. And now for the presentation.
Wow. We'll clap with you. I love it.
Now, when you say presentation, was I supposed to write something? So, I just got here.
You're present.
There's not much in here.
Yeah. Normally on these panels, every person gets about 15 minutes to kind of talk about what they're... So I'll start us off.
Okay.
I'm Elisa Wall, and... as my introduction said, I was born into a fundamentalist cult called the FLDS. I was a second-generation polygamist with my family, and so that's the lifestyle I grew up in. I was a devout believer. I believed fully and completely in my religious background, and you know, it was something we breathed, we read, we sang, we lived. It was every aspect of our life. At the age of 14, I was put into an arranged marriage, and... Oh, can't quite hear. The audience at home. Yes. That's who we're talking to today, is the audience at home. And over the next 3 years, I would have a life-altering experience that really set the tone for my ability to choose to leave the faith. I apostatized at 18, left, and started to adapt out into the outside world. Through that process of... coming into the outside world and having the realization that the lifestyle that I had lived, there was aspects of it that were absolutely not okay. Predominantly that underage marriage and the reality that my younger siblings and specifically younger sisters would be experiencing similar practice and they would go through a lot of the same experiences I had. And so I had the opportunity to testify against the leaders of the cult and have the opportunity to be involved in bringing significant change within the community. A lot of my story has been put out there. I have written a book. I've had lots of opportunity to present and speak in the world, and I am honored for that. A lot of it has to focus, a lot of that focus has been on my life within the FLDS, and not a lot of it is post-faith. And I'm grateful that this is the topic that we're talking about today, is what does spirituality post-faith look like? And I know for me it's been an ever-changing kaleidoscope of experiences. And I've had to really ask myself at every turn in my life, no matter what headspace I was in, what is spirituality? And I can tell you for me that has shifted and changed depending on what was going on in my life. You know, after I left the faith, there was this desire to seek other faith. I explored the mainstream Mormonism quite heavily. went to church for quite a long time to see if that was my niche. You know, I had this hole in my heart and my soul that I thought I needed to fill with something. You know, I needed to have a relationship with God. Soon after I left, I had children of my own, and I had the opportunity to experience motherhood. And that always radically shifts our mindset and shifts our perspective of meaning of life. And through that process, the realities of my life experience began to come in an avalanche. There was a lot of anger, a lot of PTSD, a lot of hate, a lot of blame, self-blame, but also blame for the people around me, the world around me, and what had happened. You know, there was someone that needed to be responsible for the pain that I was experiencing. And through that process, I lost all spirituality. I became very angry at God, and I threw all of it out the window and didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it really did. It changed my personality because I became so disconnected from anything outside of the pain and the hurt that I was experiencing. Through lots of different seasons of life, but predominantly going through a major collapse within my mental health and having a hard reset, you would call it, within life, and getting the experience of coming back from that and having to ask myself the hard questions and having to return to the question of spirituality, because my path of throwing it out the window was not working for me. It was eating me alive because the hole that was in there wasn't filled, and it was only becoming infested with a lot more guilt and a lot more shame and a lot more pain. Through that process, a long, beautiful process of realizing that I needed to seek more information. And I began to really seek information and wisdom in spirituality from every source I could possibly think of. And through that process, I have been able to navigate my own wilderness and find my own path to heart. And realize that it really boils down to spirituality for me is a deep journey with self. And I say journey because it isn't a destination. It's something that is consistently changing and evolving for myself. And I'm realizing that it's not a relationship with God. It's a relationship with myself. And so I was able to take spirituality and remove it from an external relationship to a very internal relationship. And it has had its ebbs and flows. And every day is a new awakening in a lot of ways because it is something that has become a vital and thriving part of my life. That's my brief snapshot.
Well, thanks for getting the ball rolling.
You're welcome.
I had a very different experience than a lot of people in Colorado City did because my dad was a science teacher. So I spent my whole life in a laboratory, basically. So I'd go to school and be in his laboratory for 16 hours a day, and then I would get placed in the religious side of things. So growing up was... what's the phrase? A lot of cognitive dissonance. And I'm still trying to, what does spirituality even mean? I mean, the definition is that you care more about someone's spirit or soul versus materialistic things. But for me, I'm not sure exactly what that means. And when I do figure it out, then it changes. So I guess it's like Elisa said, where it's not necessarily a destination. It's arriving at a point where it makes sense, and until it doesn't, which is usually pretty short. But I still am trying to figure out what all that means, and just trying to accept that you don't have to believe the same thing all the time. I mean, there have been moments where I've believed in God, and then I didn't believe in God, and then I believed in... You know, that maybe there was no answers to anything, or maybe there's no point in even searching for an answer. But to me, it just means having an open enough mind to see the possibility that it might be different than you thought it was. That's my version of spirituality. It's Roman.
Roman, okay.
Sorry.
And then I'd love to hear a little more of just your story, since I don't know you at all. Like, how'd you end up sitting here versus where you were 15 years ago?
So my dad was excommunicated But we built a 16,000 square foot house in Colorado City, all of us did. And he refused to leave, which was really unusual. So he left, or he was excommunicated, and then people just vandalized our house and, you know, slit our tires and painted our fences and broke our windows and all kinds of things like that. But he just refused to leave. He was he's just stubborn.
Scientist.
Yep. Another GD scientist. But he just refused to leave, and he was one of the first people to have the guts to speak out against Warren and the religion, and because his stepfather was the prophet before the Jeffs came in, and he was a completely different person. And so my dad saw the way his stepfather ran everything versus the way the Jeffs ran everything. And then he just slowly, I mean, that on top of reading all the geology books and biology books and, you know, comparing that to theological views is really hard to wrap your mind around. You know, when you're told that the earth is 6,000 years old, and then you go dig up fossils that are obviously a few million years old. So he was on his way out, but one day, Roland called him in to talk about his second wife, who she had a lot of trouble. She was really, really abused, and she was just a wild card, and he couldn't keep her under control. So he was called in to the prophet, and the prophet accused him of doing a bunch of things that he didn't do. So after that meeting with the prophet, then he just realized, well, if this guy's supposedly talking to God, then how come he can't see that I didn't do these things? And then from there, it was just, it went downhill really fast. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. But he just refused to leave, and we stayed there, and I left the religion when I was 16, but I stayed there for a few more years to graduate high school. And then left the town when I was 19 and moved to Salt Lake City. And then wandered around for a long time. And I'm usually not too involved in things like this, but I guess it's been so long and it's so distant now that it's more amusing than anything. So.
Luckily, someone's prepared.
I think you're at.
Oh, that's me. My name is Vance Blackmore. I grew up in British Columbia, Canada, my mom was born in Hilldale, Utah, so that's the connection to the group down here was very much marrying back and forth. I was the fourth of my dad's kids. He has 40 at this point, so I've got a lot of brothers and sisters and moms and things. I grew up in the same reality as these guys, but the story is quite a bit different. I kind of was a really good boy, and as far as the church went, and worked as hard as I could work to get to where I thought I wanted to be, and was married in the church 3 days after my 19th birthday to a 16-year-old girl from Colorado City who had recently moved to Canada after her dad had passed away. which is a really interesting reality when your whole life you're taught you're not supposed to have any communication or contact or any kind of relationship with women or the feminine aspect of life, and then all of a sudden you're married and it's like, okay, now go have children and multiply and replenish the earth, and you kind of get lost. And I did anyways. It was a hard reality to wake up to. Before that, though, because I'd got so good at turning everything off, especially emotionally disconnecting from everything, because growing up, going through puberty, watching all the girls that were my age marrying all my older relatives or my dad or my uncles or whatever else the situation was, it kind of got to a point where I got really, really numb before I was ever connected. And that was really the beginning of the end, was before it even before it even started. My whole life, even at 5 or 6 years old, I would look around and wonder what was wrong with everything. It kind of felt off the way everything was. So Cassandra, the girl that I married, Cassandra, her and I had 2 children while we were in the church, and then we both kind of got to the point where we realized it wasn't going the direction we wanted to be, and we walked away from it at that point together. Since then, we've separated, and we have 3 children, but that was the beginning. But I really, from the point of walking away from it, that's when I really threw everything out, the God and the spirituality and religion and all of the aspects of it. I figured I was already gone, so none of it mattered anyways, and I just went clear off the deep end with it. Like, in a very unhealthy way, I pursued a lot of sex in a lot of places that weren't in alignment. And ultimately that led to the separation with my wife, which was a good thing because of the direction everything had gone. But it also, it got to a point where that and the work I was doing at the time, and for a lot of years I ran heavy equipment in the logging industry and construction industries, and just the lifestyle mixed with the complete disconnect from any kind of spirit, it led to a point where I was ready to be done with this world, and very much tied myself into so many situations and so many places that I didn't think I could come back from. And I thought that suicide was the only way out. And there was a moment where that was all I could think about. And it started to really, really concern me because somewhere in me, I felt that that wasn't okay. I went the traditional method with that, where you go see a doctor and they give you a bunch of pills and away you go. You're fixed now. And that also didn't work. And I started, at that point, I started looking into other forms of spirituality, and I realized that maybe I shouldn't have thrown everything away, and I started reconnecting a lot more with the Native American sense of what spirituality was, and a broader connection to spirit, which is the understanding that spirit is everything, and it's in everything, and we're a part of all of that. So I experimented a lot with different plant medicines along that journey, which allowed me to release a lot of unhealthy emotions and reconnect back with a piece of me and start to truly form the belief and understanding that God is not out there. And God's actually only exists within all of us, and no one can take that away, and no one can get in between that connection. And for so long, all of the messages I got from church and any organized religion was you had to go through them to get to God, or to gain your salvation in some way, when the reality of it is you innately already are God, if you believe that. I mean, you can take it to whatever level you wish, but my direction has, I don't know, there's a lot of layers to the story, and I don't know how far to go into all of it, but that's in a roundabout way how we got to here.
So how did you... Because I did the same thing. You just went off the deep end for a long time. And today I was wondering why it is that everyone does that, or at least almost everyone I know. What was the reason that you went that direction? For me, it was just a complete lack of guidance.
For me, it was the desire, because I got to the point of getting to the point where I was so disconnected, where it was everything from being a little boy of, you know, boys don't cry and men don't do that and they don't even feel emotions, to like turning all of that off. It got to the point that the only way I could feel anything was through sex. It was the only way I could feel any kind of connection, and so I looked for it wherever I could find it. And that's, I don't know how everyone else's story lines up with that, but it was also to explore what the other side of it was. I figured if I was already that far into it, it's not like I was going to go to hell for it. So
yeah, it's already way too late, man.
You had mentioned something I wanted to clarify. You said that you and your wife have now separated, and you mentioned, and that's a good thing. I think the idea that I picked up was, you know, because of where you've been and where you've gone, is that to say that you feel like almost like a
codependence, or like, you know, I messed up, so it's good that we're apart, or it's good you guys aren't good together?
No, it's more of the realization that my path was a little bit different than hers. And for so long, I had sacrificed a lot of me to be on the same path as her. And so even now, we're very good friends, and I love her. I truly do love her, but we're just not going in the same exact direction, if that makes sense. I mean, we're helping each other, and we'll forever raise our kids together, but I also looked around and saw how the rest of society separated and went their own ways, and I didn't like how that looked in any way, so I truly tried and still do to keep that relationship clean and open.
And to your question of why it seems like everyone goes this way, is that a selection bias? Is that where the people you know are probably very similar to the people that I know, in the sense of like we're in a very kind of monoculture? And when I was 16, for instance, I mean, I'm 40 now almost, but when I was 16, I was doing drugs, you know, for a couple of years, and I left the church, and I'm like, this is bunk. And then I heard the voice of God, and, you know, I had done some, you know, psychoactive substances, and I didn't know for 20 years that that is a direct link. But I think going off the deep end, that was my going off the deep end, where I'm like, I was trying to get away from the things that were keeping me from feeling and understanding and even searching out myself. And in numbing myself, it's like I was trying to numb myself from feeling obligated to these outside influences that were telling me that I wasn't worthy. But it was kind of like I was pre-programmed to self-destruct if I ever went that way, because it was saying, if you leave, then you're going to do these things, and then it's going to lead to these bad things, and that's going to prove that you're you know, errant, and that you are in error. You're broken. You need something to fix you, and where did that fix? So they kind of set the stage for that. They kind of said, like, watch this magic trick. We're mentalists. We're going to tell you something, and then you're going to do it, and then you're going to see that we're right.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's actually just, I think, suggestion.
I
followed that suggestion perfectly, by the way. And it took me 20 years to then circle back around after having my, like, midlife crisis. Like, I had my faith crisis when I was 14. I had my midlife crisis that led to me recognizing that I didn't have a faith crisis. I had a truth crisis. The church was. I was seeing that. And now I go, I don't need to be unhealthy, and I can drink. I don't need to be unhealthy, and I can look at sex in a very holistic, much more healthy way. So sex is not unhealthy. Drinking is not unhealthy. Drugs are not unhealthy. You know, not meditating and just sleeping and eating chips is not unhealthy. But having unhealthy relationships with any of those things is definitely possible. And I think if we're tripped into thinking that's the only way to have a relationship with those things, and looking for any way to get away from that thing, it's like the trap that they lay is, you can escape from us, but you can't get away.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
That is, I think it's quite similar to that. But what I've noticed in coming from the FLDS is it's just a lot more intense, because once you leave, in most cases, you don't have any contact with your parents, with other siblings, so you're just on your own. And I've heard, there's a phrase I've heard a lot from kids leaving the FLDS, and that is, I'm going to hell, so who cares? It literally doesn't matter what I do. So
and that's that programming, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you do one
well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because they tell you, you're going to feel like this. And then when you get out here and you don't have any support, you do feel like that. So what other option do you have besides embrace what the only thing that you know at that point?
And I'll speak to this too, because a lot of the work I do is to assist people who choose to leave different polygamous backgrounds specifically. And one of the things that we've had to be really aware of is that the neurological reality that they're faced with. Because a lot of us that were born into a religious construct, it was a paradigm that we were born into that was defined for us. And it wasn't defined based on logic or science. It was defined based on exactly what you said, a perception of the truth. And that's where a big
dogma
comes from, it's given to us as though this is the only truth, and it's painted, and our neural pathways are premeditated. They're put into us without really our consent. And so that process of going the other direction is you become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because unless you have the skill sets, unless you have the neuroplasticity in that moment to be able to identify that you are walking down a neural pathway that was preset for you, you will end up on the other end of it, and then you'll loop back around into it. And so there's science going against us, but then there's also a reality of the depth of the programming. For a lot of people that may have joined a cult and then choose to leave, it's a very different experience as they come out of it, because they have a baseline. They have a baseline outside of the paradigm that was given to them. Whereas those of us that are born into it, that it's a fabric of our very family, then we don't have that baseline. And so, yes, the pendulum swings completely the other direction for most people. And it takes that experience. And so for a lot of people that I've worked with, I really encourage them to not for one second feel guilty or shameful of that pendulum swing, because it was absolutely necessary for them to get to where they are. And it's a beautiful journey. And it's always exciting when people can get all the way to the dark side, as we would call it, and be able to find their own path to light. Because that's really what it is in reality, is it's your own path to the light, whatever that looks like for you. So.
Families, people escaping and starting a new life, for whatever reason, like I feel a deep trauma when I watch those, and I never knew why or put any two and two together on it. But I think it's really interesting, and I wonder with people you talk to that grew up traditional LDS, I wanted to know, do you ever find yourself either counseling with or giving people advice that are in the traditional faith? Because I don't want to downplay or discard how difficult the transition was for each of you, because I really empathize with that. There's some real visual pieces of it and reality pieces of it that are so different than mine and very intense. And being a traditional Mormon and trying to leave is also very intense.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I just wanted to know, and I think anyone who listens to this or participates online, I just think there's so many traditional, I'm a very traditional LDS man, grew up regular family, dad, bishop, all the mission, all the stuff. And I feel deeply traumatized by trying to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, like, what's your experience? I've never sat in a room with people who've left such a fundamental faith in such a, like, oh my gosh, we got to hop the fence kind of way, like, let's get free. And my journey's different. But sorry, that was kind of long. But I just wonder, what's your experience?
Do you want to take it first? I do have a response.
Go ahead.
Go for it. It's interesting because, yes, the answer is, do I find myself counseling? And I do want to hear from both of these guys, too. Because of the path that I've chosen to take, where speaking out and becoming an advocate, I wrote a book about 10 years ago, and so I've had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of people in varieties of faith truth crises from the Mormon background, whether it's traditional Brighamite, all of the spectrum of it, but not just that, in any crisis, in any faith or truth crisis. And yes, I would like to speak to your question of, or your statement that it's just as traumatizing for you to leave it. And in some ways, I explain it like this. For people that are leaving a fundamentalist faith, in a lot of ways, yes, it is a difficult journey. And it is physically, emotionally, and spiritually brutal. In some ways, though, we have one valuable asset, and that is our worlds are very black and white. Because of the paradigm that we existed in, it was created to such an extreme level that it didn't have any reference points to the outside world. We were so sheltered, we were so kept away from it, that when you choose to leave, everything about your world comes crashing down. It is black and white. There's no reference points anymore. Nothing matches up. What we were told is drastically different than the reality of the outside world. And that proposes an a really valuable opportunity, because at that point in time, you do have the option to say, wow, my entire life is a lie. Whereas people who come from a more traditional path, their life is a series of shades of gray. And even the journey of leaving is shades of gray. They have to sort through this. It's not so in your face, white or black. It's a sifting process. And it's a lot more of a difficult process in some ways, because there's so much similarities in their life. It's not like their life all of a sudden changed on a dime. What changed was here. And for those of us that left the FLDS, our physical life changes, because you literally have to leave and everything about your reality shifts on a dime. Whereas people in a more traditional, even Catholic faith or Jehovah's Witness, whatever that may be, it's a lot more of a slow, gradual process. And it takes a lot more internal diligence to continue that process, because it's much easier to walk backwards. Whereas for those of us that leave the fundamentalist faith, it is, you can't walk backwards. There is no backwards walking. So I don't know if that speaks to it adequately, but it's something I have had the opportunity to witness in the work I have done. So, but.
So that's an interesting question. So in thinking about it, I wonder if it's actually harder in some ways. Where we come from, it's a yes or no question. You know, you get to a point where you're either yes or no, but in the mainstream Mormon church, it's a lot more liberal, and you're able to do certain things that might appear gray, but down there it's, and I really don't know if that's worse or better, because it is kind of nice to just get to a point where you're like, okay, I'm choosing black.
So like a scarier 100-foot guy.
Yeah, it's, what'd you,
versus the tumble down.
Yeah, what'd you, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've heard a lot of stories from people leaving the mainstream Mormon church who, in talking to them, seem like they went through more trauma than I did. And I was in a full-on cult. But there are so many different elements that form someone's emotional temperament that it's really hard to say. It all depends on your social structure. You know, with this, there's new research on PTSD that's suggesting that most of the weight of PTSD is the social ramifications of it. Is that normal in your group? Where, you know, where we grew up, it was pretty rough, at least where I was, you know, like physical abuse and all that kind of stuff. And it just didn't seem abnormal. Like, it didn't. People on the outside would look at that and go, well, that looks like trauma. But to us, it was almost a form of play in a lot of cases. But it's so different for each person. I mean, even my siblings, each person has a much harder time dealing with certain things than other people do. So I'm curious, though. Before then, you said... You heard the voice of God?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
So you want to aim in your phone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please, tell us on the mic so we can hear it later.
Hi, my name is Bob Bennett, and I born and raised LDS, and it was... When I was, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, I thought I'm going to help my friends. I committed to myself never to do drugs, smoke cigarettes. I had friends that were drinking or smoking. And after being in this culture, and the shame culture is so heavy, and the purity culture, and the, like, live up to the standards, and so much that it kind of backfires. Because, you know, my parents... You know, they asked me a number of times, like, I'd be at my friend's house and their parents smoked, and they'd be like, are you smoking weed? Because they didn't know, you know, it's nicotine versus, you know, that's just tar that's burnt. Don't worry. That's the smell that you're getting. But after hearing that enough times, I'm just like, you know what? Screw it. Like, when I was in a situation where there were drugs, and I had determined for myself, like, I don't want to do drugs. I want to help my friend not do drugs. I thought that was superior. And when I finally was kind of beat down from that constant barrage of questioning, I'm like, you know what, why should I not be doing drugs? Everyone, you know, thinks that I am anyway. And as I got into that lifestyle, it really became, I think I knew internally way deep down in my psyche that there was something wrong. It's the only thing I can imagine looking back now, because I was out. I was like disbelieving in the church, but I had really weak arguments. And then once I got deep enough into that kind of that pathway that, I mean, so I don't know. I'm sure it's probably the same way. I think this is kind of a cultural thing that happens in like the in versus out groups, but they would almost look for ways to prove that what you're doing is inferior to the way that they've set, which is right. And so if you're doing drugs or if you're hanging out with the wrong people, then they'll shun you enough to indicate like, you know, now I realize the thing that we really thrive in is good connection. And when these groups, they don't just put, like you said, a barrier between you and God. They put it between you and one of the, like, we need water, we need air, we need food, and we need human connection. And we need human connection on two levels, ourselves and with others. And these fundamental high-demand religions, I think, are really good at saying, we've got great connection. Come and fit in. And we're going to get you in touch with God, which is really just us. And so come on in and start paying your way in to get some of that. We'll teach you and we'll help you. And so when they put a barrier between some of the two of the most important nutrients that humans need, and they trick us into believing that that's the only way we can access it, we leave and we start to automatically feel this hunger from it. And some of that's real because the social connections start to be held back from us. Like, oh, you're doing drugs. You're going to start feeling like bad. And in the meantime, they're doing this. Uh-huh. Like, see how you're feeling bad? And it's like, well, you just turned your back on me. They're like, that has nothing to do with it. It's because you're doing drugs, bro. And so it's kind of funny how they play, and we believe that. And my 16-year-old self didn't see that. So when I'm finally hitchhiking, literally with one bag to California, Santa Monica, to stay with some friends, halfway there in Reno, I find out that I can't. Like their landlord put the clamp down on that. So I had to turn back around and be in Salt Lake on the streets. And I'm now just day to day living on the streets, making my way and just panhandling for food and drugs. And I would get a little bit of weed and a Whopper. I love the Whoppers, you know. And then finally one day, after about 5 weeks of that, I had met this skinhead that wanted to just create problems. And I'm not really a fighter, but he challenged me and said, I think you're, you know, someone that has tangoed with me and I don't have proof, but if I find it, then I'm going to kill you. And a week later, I heard a friend on the phone one night saying, hey, that guy, you know, he said my name and he said, he's here. You know, the guy you wanted to kill. So I took off. I was outside their apartment. I took off and I had just, you know, for the first time in my life prayed sincerely. I'd said lots of prayers like, dear Heavenly Father, like, you're a dick, so if you're going to, like, come and save me, then save me, you know? But now I'm really deeply in trouble, and I'm like, I need your help. I need you. Will you help me? This is not the way my life's supposed to end. And he says, will you quit drinking? Will you quit smoking? Will you quit doing drugs? And I'd heard that in the back of my head so many times in my life. And, you know, who would have thought that a Mormon 16-year-old boy who's been through all the classes and all the Sunday school lessons about drugs and drinking and you know, smoking and, you know, the word of wisdom, who would have thought that those would have been the thoughts that came to my mind when I felt guilty about something or was looking for ways why my life was wrong? And as I said that, I just thought, I don't know how to get out of this. I don't know what to do. I don't even know how to do that. And I heard that just like you hear my voice. Like, I heard a voice. And it said, drinking, smoking, doing drugs. I said, I'll do whatever. Just help me up and guide me. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Instantly, the effects that I was feeling of the fear and the drugs were gone. I knew where to go. And everything worked out. And so that was proof to me that God existed. He guided me in that path to get out of that hole in my life. And right back into the church, you know, less than a year later, I had a testimony. I was so strong. I could testify. I could bring a whole congregation to tears. And I believed it. It was a part of my soul. It was the realest thing I'd experienced. I communed with God. I was Alma the Younger. And then 20 years later, I read a book called Stealing Fire that says, this is the guy that did that to me, by the way. He introduced me to that. He's a bad guy. Bad man.
That's a great friend.
Yeah.
No, that's a bad man.
And bad man. Evil. And suddenly I realized the entheogens, psychedelic drugs, can make you experience, you know, the presence or the communion with God And it can feel more real than like the birth of your own child, than the time that you like break a leg or whatever. It can be more real and more lasting and deep. And now all of a sudden I'm like, I had the most real thing I'd ever experienced that I can know. I don't know what's going on with the rest of the universe, or the rest of the world, or the rest of my family, but I know that God personally knows me and loves me and spoke to me. And then I'm like, oh, and now I can't know that anymore. Shit. Sorry, but that messed me up. And after going through that process of realizing I can't go back in time and really evaluate, was that what happened or was it God? Because it was so real. And I didn't want to believe it, but I was too curious to stop asking. So I finally designed a system, you probably might be, of tests to be able to figure out if I can recreate that kind of scenario. And then I saw God. Spoiler alert, God's a spaceship, but anyway, it's a long story, we can talk about it another time, but I validated to myself that yes, I can be, I can experience something that I think is maybe one thing, or that feels like, or looks like one thing, that I perceive as one thing that is totally different. And that was the start of the end for me, where I'm like, my feelings and my perceptions are, I can't really trust those in the way that I thought I could. And it was a little bit scary, but it also was freeing to say, now I can make space for, a much wider perception of what's going on. I can see the rainbow instead of the gray, black and white, what's in between there. Oh, if there's room, it's gray. It's a whole rainbow. It's a whole spectrum. And that beauty has far replaced the fear of, maybe I don't know. Now I don't know, and there's so much beauty in its place. So that was my... Sorry to make that a long, but that
no,
was...
No, that was great, and I'm curious. So when you got the phone call that guy was looking for you, were you on anything?
Oh, yeah, I didn't make that clear. Half an hour earlier, I dropped acid.
Okay.
And so, and that's... That, to me, when I said amen, I was clear as day. I was as cognizant and as sober as I'd ever been. But was I, that was really me, leaning maybe into the experience. And I don't know if I was actually sober. And that's where I was like, I don't know what happened. I had my own way of telling the story and thinking about it and reflecting on it. But yeah, that was definitely under the influence of one of the few chemicals in the world that can make you commune with God like that, if the circumstances are right. And it did. And so... it was really enlightening for me to go back and have to unwire all of that, and it took some time. That was probably the hardest part, learning that the church is saying things that are demonstrably not true. That made me angry, but the thing that really turned me out of my certainty was knowing that I could no longer in good conscience believe that that happened the way that I had believed it did and said that it did and knew that it did. I knew no longer knew. And that not knowing was such a freedom for me. Scary, like I said, but it was...
So how long did it take from you having that experience to admitting that you still don't know?
Having which experience?
So you're saying you heard the voice of God.
16.
Yeah, and then now you're saying you don't know for sure what exactly that means?
I'm pretty confident that I know what that was. It was a chemically induced hallucination. And I don't think it's as ugly as that sounds. I think when the brain, we dream incredible things. I've had dreams where I can jump up high enough to fly, and then I can zoom all around. That's awesome. And I think when people are taking these chemicals, it can reduce the barrier between reality and that imaginative space. And we can be awake during that process, right? And we can remember and be aware of it and in the real world, but also in kind of a dream state or an imaginative state. I think that's what happens when people go, hey, I want the thing that I can't get when I'm lucid. And that part of the brain that's usually locked away to dream state goes, what do you want? It's like, is God real? Oh, yeah, let me serve him up, So I think that's kind of what happened for me. I needed some kind of validation. And the only thing, this goes back to the programming, the only thing I was told could validate me and my existence and my purpose was God. So I said, I need something. And the brain goes, well, I know what to serve you. God is the thing that you can't find in all the times that you've prayed or searched or wondered, but I can give it to you. My brain did give it to me in a really compassionate, even way to say, this is, you know, what you need right now to move into a healthier space. So I don't like look at it as all bad or all good or right or wrong, but I do think my brain knew something. And even if that programming, if I would have been programmed to say like, oh, it's meditation, then I would have meditated. Instead, I prayed to Heavenly Father, the white bearded dude who also has an identical looking son that, you know, in his name. But I think that's not necessarily the only answer of what would have gotten me out of that. But I did believe that because of that programming, that was the only path out. Well, and for me, it was a path out. So it was proof that it's true. Does that make sense?
One thing I've noticed, though, is the voice of God is a lot different when you're in a pickle.
Yeah.
You know, because that when your actual safety is in jeopardy, that voice is a lot different than watching a hummingbird fly, you know?
Yeah.
Which in both cases people describe as the voice of God.
Yeah.
So I think, like you were saying, it's just you thought that you might die, plus acid.
Yeah.
And of course, your safety's in jeopardy, so you use the only tool you know at that point, which is to believe that you're going to be okay.
Yeah. And acid was a catalyst of that, by the way. I don't think that's the exclusive way, but it did help. It was a lubricant to that process. And had I not been on acid, I probably would have had a moving experience. And I had a supernatural experience where I heard a voice. I mean, it was as real as the voice in the room, but it was up here. And I couldn't perceive that because of this lubricant, right? Uh-huh. But yeah, anyway, so.
So thank you for sharing.
I'm still kind of curious, though. So what is when your safety is not in jeopardy, what does the voice of God sound like? Because you still believe in God, right?
I don't.
You don't at all?
No. I've settled in atheism. I don't think... I think the best explanation that I have for what's going on, and I would welcome... I mean, I think it would be fun in a novel way even to get up and have like a super prick God. Mm-hmm. Be like, you didn't take the sacrament with your left hand or with your right hand 42 times out of thousands. Sorry, it's the terrestrial kingdom for you. Like, I think that would be fascinating for a novelty's sake. It would suck, you know, mm-hmm. to be banished for stupid reasons and to realize that the king of the universe is like a petty being. But I think that the thing that... for me, it fits best is I'm comfortable with any outcome if I'm living present, and I believe that when I close my eyes for the last time and take my last breath, that's it. I'm going to cease to have any consciousness beyond that. Now, I don't know if that's true, and I certainly hope that like I'll get up there and we'll all sit in a big campfire and everyone will be welcome and we'll all learn and grow. And no matter what we did here, it will be a lesson to be learned, but... I don't know what the end thing is. All I know is that taking away like the fact that I matter eternally, like in 4 billion years, I don't think there'll be any indication that I ever existed. And that frees me from, you know, you lose like, oh, my sense of worth, like I'm so important, like I'm important enough that the universe is gonna like have my worlds in it one day. That's one thing that you lose, but what I've gained is, I think, the realization that I messing up is okay, living and being present and paying attention, and I don't have to say, like, am I worthy enough to ask for that thing that I want? I can want it, I can ask for it, and if somebody says, like, pound sand, then it's because they said pound sand, not because I'm inherently lacking enough worth to be, to earn it. So I still like ask for what I want and I get it. It's kind of awesome. So I get to live in like the like a privileged place or in a privileged state, and I don't have to be worthy of it. I can just ask for it, and it's a much more human level. And then I can make room for people that are asking for it to be like, for sure, it's your turn.
First of all, thank you for sharing all that. So beautiful.
Can we delete the recording?
It was beautiful. Is
this being recorded?
Yeah.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask, I think there's so many people out there that could benefit from hearing what you're talking about today, especially from the mainstream Mormon faith. I think there's such a deep undercurrent of people in their 30s and 40s that have so many questions that are still kind of going to church. I'm probably a good example. I don't go to church anymore. But none of my friends, like I'm semi-high-profile Mormon, and nobody knows I'm here. And I've been out of the church for 10 years.
And so you can't even talk about this stuff? Is that
not? Yeah, I don't talk about this stuff to anyone.
So,
but I just think there's so many people who are in a position of saying, like, I want deeper spirituality, you know, kind of the theme of this presentation. I want to feel connected, but I just don't, and something's wrong. And something innately feels weird, but culturally I can't. I just don't have the courage to literally turn the keys in the car and leave in the middle of the night.
Well,
regular Mormons just can't do that.
Well,
just
it
stick
starts
around forever in that place of unsafety, and it is terrible.
Well, it's even worse than that because there's a lot of groundwork you have to do before you even turn the keys on the car. You have to have a dialogue with yourself or someone about it. And even, because that's the thing, is the culture is set up so that, at least in my culture, you just don't even ask that question, because if you ask that question, it's already over.
It's the same in mainstream.
So everyone's just trapped in this system where if someone tells you you can't talk about something, that's called a cult. If you can't even have that dialogue.
That's, I think you can actually speak to this a little more because your transition out was a lot smoother.
It was. That was an interesting situation with it. I didn't get completely shunned by my family when I did it. My mom was really like, you know, you should come to church, until she got really tired of saying it and then she quit. And she still probably thinks I should go to church. But I think it's the same thing. It goes back to the same thing, and that is that the spiritual abuse that's happening from the inception of all of this. Like, truly, if you're baptized into it before you're old enough to understand, which is in every religion at this point, and most of them are when you're an infant. And then I remember getting baptized when I was 8 years old, and I was thinking the day before, because I'm like, I'm going to have all my sins washed away tomorrow. What can I do tonight then? Because this is... And at 7, what can you do wrong at 7?
If like, only you knew the options. Right?
But...
I love you, bud.
It was...
Let's just say that he did not grow out of that.
Yeah, what did you do that night?
He still has the tendency.
I can't remember. but because of that, like, I think the disconnect that we all feel, especially the men, we don't understand that it's in the patriarchy. Like, we so call it the priesthood, and we give all of that power to it, to the point where we have no power. We don't have the power to make the choice to go be our own self because we think it needs to come from some higher spiritual being, which from all of our experience has to come through the lineage, that whoever's sitting on the pulpit saying they hold the keys, whatever the keys are, no one knows, or where they go or what car they start, but they got the keys. No one else does. And God only talks to them. It's not what's talking to all of us. So I think that we learn to really close that down along with our emotions. I think that's the biggest thing, is the emotional disconnect. And that becomes the cancer that eats at all of us, really. Like, especially the men, and I keep going back to that because that's the... For me, it felt like they were always the ones that had the voice. Even the point when I was married into it and it felt like, okay, now I'm supposed to be the man of the family. And at the same time, the woman that I got married to her dad had just passed away. So she was the oldest one at home, and she was really depressed. Clearly, it was 6 months after her dad had passed away. And the answer that the church had for her feeling where she was to marry her to me. And their answer for me was to marry me to her because, you know, I had put in so much work to get to that point. But I was so disconnected at that point and spiritually non-existent because I had already felt like I was at a place where there was no way I was actually going to make it anyways. If I actually followed the rules to what they were saying, I didn't qualify. And the reconnection to the Spirit, though, like I think that's an ongoing process. It's not something that just happens or just happened. And I think everyone here, even anyone here choosing to look at it or even questioning their own belief system right now, it's not just going to wake, they're not going to wake up one day and all of a sudden be connected and feel like they're connected to everything that is and go live a new life. It's going to be a very long process of sorting through all of the shit that's not theirs, that's been spoken to everyone for however many years this has all been going on.
How much of that is the weight of shame that you guys are having to fight through? Because I think when I speak to people in Mormonism, they're like, the heaviest toll comes through shame and guilt that's it's abused and abusively placed on everybody to say, you're not enough. Is that the heart of the matter? Or is that just a small component?
That's one of the components. I think it's all of those. It's shame, blame, guilt, fear. It's because for me, like, I truly believed just before I got married, like in 2000, that was going to be the end. Like, that was very much what the leaders of our particular little cult were.
The end of the world or end of...
Yeah, like the end of everything. Everything was going to end, and it was just, I came to this same point where I was like, well, fuck, I'm not going to make it, and I'm only 16. Like, what can I do now that's... I'm going to jump back off this wagon. I guess I was looking for a long time to jump off the wagon, but yeah, it's all of those. It's all of those negative and heavier energies.
So I'm kind of curious. So has everyone in here been baptized? So for me, I didn't realize that I was the only one that felt like they had to get everything out before I got baptized, because I was terrified. My mom came to me and told me, you can't do anything bad after this. So I remember being in my dad's van going up to the place where we got baptized and sitting in the back by myself and just repeating, shit, hell, damn, piss. Shit, hell, damn, piss. I'm like, I got to get this out now. I got to get it out. And then I went and got baptized, and it was unbelievably terrifying. For an 8-year-old, where you, I think that's where PTSD comes from, is doing things like that. For an 8-year-old to be told that anything after that is they're going to hell, that's how PTSD starts. And then after I got baptized, I was sitting in the back of my dad's van on the way home, just still terrified. And my sister was sitting next to me, and she just reached out and grabbed my hair and yanked it. And I turned to her and I said, you bitch. And she said, you're going to hell.
I would like to speak to the shame and the blame, guilt train, because it's something that I think that has been my struggle. And there's a couple of components to it, because he said everything matters, but the components. As a female in my community, there was a different sense of hierarchy, and I appreciated that Vince talked about the patriarchy, because we were one more level removed from spirituality, from connection to God, because we could only get that through a man. And so there's the worth, because I was worthless without a connection to a man, and then to priesthood, and then to God. So it was this almost, I would never, ever be enough. And that was a theme that followed me through a long time. Another component for me was, because I think a lot of people, and I hope people that are listening here that have experienced any kind of pain or trauma in the name of God can hear this. Because it's a level of sinister that is very difficult to untangle. For so much of my life, some of these horrific events that happened were in the name of God. They were in the name of God. And not just that, is the very God that I was praying to obviously I wasn't good enough and wasn't listening because it was continuing to happen and it was getting significantly worse and worse and worse. And so these layers of trauma were happening in the name of God. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, having miscarriages or a stillbirth child and being told it's because you're not worthy enough. And so it was a theme that really did begin to create a belief about self that took many years to untangle. And I've noticed that you don't have to come from a traumatized background or a fundamentalist background to experience that theme. It's something that a lot of people work with, no matter if they're from religion or not. Right. It's the sense of worth. And in part of that, it was my journey of leaving, trying to find God, and then throwing it out the window. My extreme was anger and hatred, because I thought, of course, if there is a God that would allow that to happen under his watch, he can go to hell. And so it was a very different perspective with it. And but in my years of seeking my own truth and really getting to a point where I took on shame and blame and guilt, because I realized that all of those themes really continued to disconnect myself, because the shame was such a part of it, but I was just continuing the tapes that were being played for me over and over and over. And it took me realizing that I was continuing to give them my power, continuing to give them my belief, because I continued to believe I was worthless. I continued to believe I was not enough. And I continued to listen to shame and listen to guilt. And then I would blame it. I would blame it on God because, well, he started this shit show. So, but
well said.
Through that process, it got to even something where, I've discovered a lot of really great people that are working in these fields, Brené Brown and some of these other amazing people that work to speak directly to shame, directly to guilt, and how those affect the brain and how they affect your logic, how they affect your decision making, and how they affect that image of self. And that was really important to me to realize that the information that I had was so grossly incorrect. And to have that process of going through and seeking more information and more ideas of self and value, and being able to break free of the constraints of the patriarchy and realize that I didn't have to be attached to a man to have any value, that I didn't have to, and going through years of independence, and even something as simple as learning to keep a shame journal. There was a good year of my life where I kept a journal, and every time I thought of something shameful, I would write it down. And that was such an awakening process, because I realized that it was literally built into the fabric of my core. And so if I really wanted to root that out, I had to begin to detangle it. And it was a painful, emotional, but very cathartic process to see it that brutally.
So. I was going to ask if you guys are dialed into Brené Brown. So you mentioned her. Is that sweeping at least some of your world as much as it is mine? Because I hear so many people that, even people that are fully entrenched in Mormonism, they hear that clarion call. They're like, oh, Brené Brown, it's mm-hmm. a breath of fresh air, and they don't recognize why, but it is a balm to their soul. So is that pervading also kind of some of your community, or is it different?
I know a lot of people who have read her books.
Yeah. Out and in? Or do you know?
No, just out.
Just out.
The ones that are in, it's way underground.
Yeah.
It's gone further. The one that's, all of the ones that are in, like, I still have family, I think all of us do, still in that side of it, and they're getting farther and farther into it.
Is that because of the media and stuff, and is that just a kind of an effect of shame hiding, like, oh, this bad religion, and then it drives it deeper instead of helping it to...
Well, I think the main thing is that it's on its way out. And when systems that big, because at its height it was 12,000 people, in a full-on cult. So when that starts to crumble, at the very end, everyone's just clambering for any sort of mental foothold or emotional foothold. And the people getting out, like I said before, the most important thing is to just be able to have the dialogue. to be able to talk about it. If you can't do that, if you can't talk to yourself about it or anyone else, then I just don't know what else you can really do.
And as hard as it is, it's like watching like my sister. I have an older sister with 8 or 9 kids at this point. That's very much, I haven't seen her in 12 years. And it's just to the point where they're so segregated and they're so, they've, for so long the outside world has been so bad and everything that's happened has proved it. And so now they've just completely closed off even more to the point where until something in their life drastically shakes it and breaks it apart and makes them have to start questioning themselves, at that point it's the only time you can actually even talk to them or have the ability to reach them. Because right now I know that if I went and I in any way tried to even show her the truth of what that has happened in that direction, she wouldn't see it. She wouldn't even if it was played right in front of her face, she would choose to not see it.
I was going to ask if you guys have the same savior complex that mainstream Mormons do, and it sounds like you maybe you're wiser to know that that's worth it. I mean, you know, eventually you figure out, like, oh, that's just not going to help. But it's hard because we want to go back and now save, enlighten, wake up the people that we care about that are still in. And there's such a gap, a divide of, like, you just can't cross that chasm until they throw the rope. Once they throw the rope, there's enough people over there that you throw the rope over, and they light it on fire with kerosene. They're just like, get that rope off our side.
Yeah,
it's interesting you bring that up because I experienced the savior complex in an extreme way. Because being kind of a spearhead in a movement to create change, I felt a lot of responsibility. But I realized the reason I was dealing with that complex was because I actually wasn't saving myself. And I was so afraid to work on myself and reconnect and save myself that I had to find someone to save. And, man, I worked hard. I sacrificed a lot. And I lost a lot of years trying to save somebody else. And so, yeah, it is. There is a value to that in a way, because it shows me that I still have compassion. It may be misaligned. And when I see people that are experiencing that, and I do, I have a lot of empathy and compassion for them. And for anyone out there that is experiencing that feeling of wanting to save someone else more than themselves, I really hope that they take a minute to look at themselves in the mirror. Because you talk about the human connection. And in an essence, all human connection really is we show up as mirrors for one another. So when you're looking at someone and you want to save them, they are a mirror to you, and there's something within you that is crying out to be saved, to be healed, to be soothed. And so, yes, it is. And it was a valuable journey for me to experience that complex, because at least it gave me something to continue to hold on to. And for me, it was, I wanted to save my siblings, my little sisters, my mother, and I had to have that painful wake-up call of that I couldn't save anyone. Not even myself. You know, I found myself in a hospital going crazy, and I realized, wow, I've lost everything. I can't even save myself. And but that was the birth of me saving myself. So.
You don't know me, bro. Leave me alone. No, it's exactly right. And it's that. But we, again, it's one of those things where we're trained to always look outward. We look outward of the community. We say, like, anywhere out there, there's an assassin waiting, laying in wait, the flaxen cord. And we don't, like, see ourselves being wrapped up by the community. And then we're like, look outside yourself and you'll find yourself. I mean, I don't know if that's part of your guys' dogma, but, like, you know, lose yourself to find yourself. And it's a worldly thing. It's not, Mormonism just does it well. And maybe the sects do as well. But I think it's kind of a trip to go, I'm missing the whole view because I'm looking out there, and I'm not paying attention to right here, and that's hard because we've almost been guilted and shamed into, like, looking inward. It's called selfishness. It's called indulgence. And instead, I can see lots of people, and they point to, like, oh, he's having sex with anyone he wants. He's just serving himself. And actually, here you are. You made it out another side. I'm not saying it's the most healthy or the least healthy way. It's a way. And when we stop attaching the shame to, like, you shouldn't do it that way, he did. You did. Here you are. I don't know what, here I am. You know, I dropped acid. You had sex. You have great curly hair. I don't know. what are we supposed to do except just embrace these experiences and say, this is part of the fabric of diversity. We can all learn from it. If we remove that layer of shame, there's such a rich tapestry here. And I'm just learning to access that. But
I think that's what the savior complex in me calls to, like, guys, get rid of the shame layer, and there's this tapestry, and they're like, shame, shame, shame. Mm-hmm. And that frustrates me. I just don't.
Well, I think this is important to me because it's something that I had to learn, and it's only been a recent journey. And realizing that because of all the narrative of being selfless and being selfish and all of the dogma around that, that is one of the greatest lies of our reality of where we were all raised, is they disconnected us from self. Because that's really the only way you can implement all of the rest of the crap, is you have to sever that from such an early age and from so many generations. You know, sacrifice self above all things. And it's a very, very difficult mindset to get out of, because it makes you feel all of the good feelings that you're supposed to feel. You know, that spirit of God that's supposed to vibrate inside of you, you only feel it when you're sacrificing yourself. And it's sometimes difficult for me to admit that it took me many, many years post-faith to really understand that. And so for anyone that is out there wishing to save someone, yes, but the best, most effective way you can actually save someone, because you can, is do it yourself. Save yourself and show, you know, let people experience what you look like without this cloud of shame around you. Let them experience what the words are coming out of your mouth that don't have shame involved with them. And it's interesting when your mind chooses to make that shift, how you see it in the world around you. The verbiage you use, the thoughts you think, the songs you listen to, the material you choose to read, everything shifts and changes because you're no longer under that cloud of self worth, of lacking self-worth. And so, yes, just find your own success, and it is the most effective way to assist others.
That Marianne Williamson quote of, who are you not to matter or to, you know, to excel, whatever her quote is, but that idea of, you know, there is more here, and that can actually have a much bigger impact if it's cultivated.
Yeah.
So I had a quick question, I guess more towards Elisa. As you do your work with people that are looking to leave and transition out of fundamentalism, we've already kind of covered that anybody that's in, you know that there's only so much that you can approach with them. You can't try and save everyone. But people that are actually trying to come out, but you know how sensitive that is. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you work as a conduit in between so that you don't overshoot, like you don't overwhelm them too much? Like, we've talked about how gradual a process can be or how quickly it can go, how smoothly it can be. How do you help smooth that out for them and make sure that you don't, because I mean, everybody's kind of sitting there on the fringe where they could retrench really quickly or they could overshoot and overcorrect really quickly as well.
Yes. And that moment's really important.
It is really important. Yeah. It's interesting you bring this up, because in all the work that I've done, I have many examples of those first moments and how poignant those are. And one of the things that I've realized, and I share with a lot of the people in different organizations that I worked with, is the difference between sympathy and empathy. Because it's really easy when someone's very first coming out, because you're so emotionally connected to the experience that they're going on, for you to respond emotionally to what you know they're about to face. It comes up, it rises up, this fear, this like, oh, hold on feeling, because you get it. But to understand that what they really need in that moment is empathy. Because when you transition over into sympathy, and it's this idea that they are less than because of their experience, and instead of, I don't really truly understand what you're going through because I'm not you, but I am here. And it allows for them to begin that first step in that relationship with self, because it's not about me. It's not about me saving them. It's them saving them. And so it's kind of a complex theory that I'm explaining, but it's the most effective way that I have found to truly meet people where they're at, and to always consistently offer the opportunity for them to excel. Because it's so easy, especially when people have left and they're trying to do a support system, to cap what people are capable of and to think we know what they need. We can get a series of things to help them and to assist them through that. But at the end of the day, they're their own person in their own journey. And so I've had to step back many times and realize that I didn't know anything, and that I got to listen to them and show empathy and to show complete faith in them as a person and commitment to their journey as a person, not their journey out, but them on their journey. So,
this is kind of a strange segue, but I was listening, or I was watching an interview with, forget it, he's a pop star, Marilyn Manson. So Marilyn Manson was interviewed after, or sorry, not Marilyn Manson, who is it? Oh wait, it is Marilyn Manson. He was interviewed after the Columbine shooting because a lot of people blamed Columbine on his music. And someone interviewed him and said, so what would you say to these kids, if these two kids that went into school and killed all these people, what would you say to them if you were face-to-face? And all he said was, I'd listen. Because that's really the only thing you can do. You can't presume to know what to do, especially if you haven't just sat there and listened to them. And that's really all anyone's looking for. That's what that message says, is please listen to me. Because no one's doing that. Why? Because they think you're weird. But if everyone would just stop presuming that the behavior of this person is some fault instead of an expression, then that wouldn't happen.
That's a good one.
This might be a little bit same freeway, different lane, but just talking about faith after faith or a transition, like I felt like I resonated with some of what you said, like my post-Mormon transitional work has gone deeply into men's work, and I host and lead some men's work that involves more tradition and rites of passage and the plant medicine and any of those things to help men realize their own potential and dig into the masculine energy and also to embrace their feminine energy and all those things that, of course, aren't part of traditional Mormonism. But at the same time, like, I feel like I have felt all those feelings of, like, if I'm leaving Mormonism behind, I have to leave everything. And I've had a tremendous fall, even in my 40s, of just like everything crashing down. And I just, even hearing all of your stories too, I just think it must be part of the human experience to collapse and then be reborn. It's a beautiful metaphor, but I think it's neat. It's neat that we get to do it. And I'm always grateful for my roots of traditional Mormonism. Like when you guys say fundamental cult, I wonder, do you think of that separate from traditional Mormonism? Because I feel that way about traditional regular Mormonism.
I'm always surprised how similar it is.
Okay.
It's really not much different. Geographically, that changes things because they're out in the middle of nowhere.
It looks way different on the outside.
More isolated.
It's obviously more conservative. But it's still the same thing planted in everyone's heads in the same way. They just happen to be in a location where they can still do that. But when you're... That's why it's so important. Someone asked me... I was on a panel a few weeks ago, and someone asked me, you know, what do we do? What do we do to help all these people in Colorado City? And I said, well, you poke holes in the ceiling so a little bit of light comes in. And the way you do that is go down there. You know, every time some new person comes into the community and they see this person, this human, that is obviously way different than them, and they're having a great time. So if they just get exposed to more, like I think the most important thing anyone can do when they're struggling with almost anything is travel. Get outside yourself. Go see what else is out there. Go see how people in a different country are dealing with the exact same thing you're dealing with, because it's not, it's all exactly the same. It just looks way different.
Thanks.
There's a part of it too, like for me, and I know there's one side where it's like, oh, there's that cult, but the experience that I had in that cult, only that way, was I was exposed to every kind of job that anyone here has, like from building houses to running equipment to like just the whole gamut of things. And so I ended up with an education that you cannot buy. And almost everyone from that background has that education. Whether they're willing to look at it or not at this point, it's kind of a fresh thing for most people to sit down and realize, oh, well, I'm actually very blessed with this understanding of how the world works. It might have, the spiritual side was a little tweaked, but the reality of it now is I can go anywhere and I can get a job that's a very well-paying job anywhere doing almost anything because I grew up exposed to so many different groups within the collective that did all those things. From farming, I grew up driving tractors when I was 9 years old with my dad, and then by the time I was 15, I was driving million-dollar equipment in the bush, and like different, which no one has that experience. But I don't know. There's on one hand, it's like I feel the pain and the heaviness that comes with all of it, and on the other hand, it's this awareness, knowing that everyone that is coming out of that, well, as soon as they choose to look at it, has a very big advantage over a lot of people. And not to take advantage of anyone, but just the advantage that they have from all of that experience.
What I hear is a very familiar sentiment, which it's a meditation that I hear a lot of the people in my community that, you know, like my little local people that I know that are leaving or that have been through this, and it's this attempt to say, I recognize that it would be easy to apply the same dogma that ruled and ran roughshod through my life to say, like, good, bad, or like, good, bad. And I could apply that same dogma, black and white thinking, to now, as I step outside of that community and look in on it, like, bad. But it's like, no, I actually need to recognize, you know, good, bad, you know, healthy, unhealthy, and then outside looking in, healthy, unhealthy, and more healthy, less healthy, you know, and finding ways to say, that's a little less healthy than what I can do right now, even if it's better for me, and I will work towards that, and that's okay. Or that's unhealthy, and I'm going to keep doing it until I figure out how to stop, and that's okay. And so that black and white, I have to stop, I have to do it, that kind of disappears to, I think, a more holistic sense of, you know, there was something beautiful about being raised in a cult. Mm-hmm. And there's something beautiful about being out of it. And part of that beauty, ooh, I want to grip my teeth and not say it, is that I see that it's the same outside as it was in. Mm-hmm. And that it's the contrast, I keep remembering, that it's the contrast that brings the real enlightenment or sense of like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm on the point of a mountain. I'm looking straight down, but when I look out, I go, oh, there's altitude. It's by then going down below and seeing the point of the mountain, now I have reference. It's having that contrast that really helps orient us more than the point that, where we came from or where we're going to.
Well, and that's why they try not to educate anyone, is because that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's the ability to travel, you know, mentally or emotionally. And when you keep them in a group where they're not allowed to move around very much, you can't get that perception of it.
We're over, but if you guys want to go, nobody else needs to go, so I think it's up to you guys.
I have a burning question. I think you have a burning comment.
I was just going to say that contrast, really, if you boil it down, truly, and there's one word for it, gratitude. And it's very effective, because it's something that it doesn't matter if you're in or out or wherever you are. We as humans and on our human experience, we do have that nut in our repertoire of gratitude. And really, that's, you know, they say the path to spirituality begins with gratitude, because it's being able to take where you have been and where you are and see that contrast and hold a space of gratitude where it's like, wow, that's amazing. And because that gratitude opens the door for a whole different perspective. So.
Yeah, my dad was, he did things pretty unusually. And one of the things he would do every year when I was growing up is he would take, and there were a lot of us, he would take us all to Tijuana. And we would wander the streets of Tijuana for, you know, 3 or 4 days. And when I got back to Colorado City, I thought, this is great. You know, and it's still a lot of bad stuff happening, but you go anywhere and you really take a look at what other people's struggling with, it goes back to gratitude. You go back and you go, oh, well,
I gotta get here.
Yeah, I got smacked around a couple times, but at least I'm not on the street, you know. It's pretty rough there.
Yeah.
And it was a good eye-opener, you know, because there were... I just remember seeing groups of people on skateboards with no limbs, you know, going around the city, and that's how they lived. And when you see that, then the other things, like, you know, not being able to watch a movie or read a book, all of a sudden are not really that big of a deal.
Yeah. And you guys don't probably know about Mormon ads, but the truth is, if ice cream is, like, the alternative to, like, moldy bread, then you can't eat around the cockroach. You know, like, you know, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to just be dogmatic and say, throw it out. And if we apply that same standard to Mormonism, we say, throw it out. There's so many cockroaches, and there's so much ice cream. And if we, or fruit, or whatever, the, you know, the thing is. You had a burning question. I don't want to take it.
With permission, can I ask one last question? Like, knowing what you know and sticking to the topic of faith after
Mormonism.
I don't know if all of you have kids, but those of you that do, I would love to know, because I'm in that place. I ask myself a lot, what will I teach my children? And I really appreciate what you guys just said, too, because I think there is beauty in all of it. But I wonder, I would really love to know what each of your thoughts are on, like, what then to teach the children of the next generation. Is it to have faith in a religion, or is it to have no construct in hopes that they'll find their own thing, or what is it? What do we teach our kids?
I don't have kids, so.
You probably know.
He is a giant kid.
That might be right. My brain's not all messed up.
You didn't have to cut pieces out.
Yes, this is actually something that's near and dear to me right now in my life, because I have older kids. I have a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old. And I have reached a really interesting point in our relationship, because I realized how much of their life has raised me. And they've had the opportunity to see very different sides of their mom. And we've been on this journey together. And so it's always this question of what do I teach them? Because there was a lot of fear. It was a fear-based mindset I was coming from, because I thought, I can't teach them anything because that's my own crap, and I don't want to give any crap to them. And then seeing how I have changed and how I have transitioned and how I've connected with self, especially in this last year. It's you saw me last year, and people that know me, they've seen a radical shift in this last year, because a lot of parts and pieces that I'd been working on kind of all came together in this beautiful little bow. And I've realized that one of the things that's important for me to teach my children is that connection to self. Because I look back on my own journey, and I realize the areas that I went really astray was when I really went against self, when I went against that intuition, when I went against my heart path, whatever that looks like for people. And that's where it really got me into trouble. And it's not about teaching them right or wrong. I think it's much more simplistic than that. It's the humanity, reminding them of the humanity within all of us. And how that looks very differently. And a big piece of that is gratitude. It's kind of a hard concept to teach kids in this day and age, because they lack for nothing. And I can't tell you how many times in this journey I've been like, well, if you guys would have grown up the way I was, you would have, you know. And teaching them that warped perspective of comparison, because here I am comparing my life experience with the ease and the lifestyle they have now, and that's very unfair to them. And it's allowed me that journey of letting go of that comparison, letting go of that, and reconnecting with how simple it really is. It's connection to self, and to consistently seek more information and never be afraid to question anything. And be excited for me, helping them realize, especially in this last year, because they have seen me shift quite radically in beautiful ways. But by me doing that, by me being willing to question, even as a 32-year-old woman, to question everything in my life and to be able to get more in alignment with myself And they see it on my face. They see it in my attitude, my personality shifts and changes, my happiness, my release of blame, the way that I speak differently. They've gotten to see that, and they're picking up their own pieces with it. And so I wish I could say, oh, I'm going to teach him this, and I'm going to teach him that. But what I will definitely do is I will practice gratitude. I will practice self. And I will practice consistently that journey of self, because I know that that is truly the only way I teach them.
For me, it's... So I have my oldest daughter just turned 15, and it's been interesting watching the difference from when I was a kid, because there was no TV. There was none of that reality at all. And then because we've stepped so far out of it now, our kids are very much exposed to everything anyone else's kids are. That they have unlimited access to everything, which is insane. But that's the world we live in. And it's seeing how the direction of mainstream society is, that, you know, when you grow up and you start having relationships with partners and friends, and that there's someone out there for you, like there's this something out there for you and you need to go find it and then you'll be happy. And I think that's a major flaw in where society's going right now, and what's being portrayed and has been for a long time on TV, is this idea that there's this special someone out there that's going to make someone happy. And helping them understand that before they even step into any kind of that, looking outside of self, they need to be very aware of what's inside and how connected they are with who they are and what they are, instead of going out to try to change who they are to be with someone so that someone will accept them for who they are. Instead, be very aware of who they are and then just be that. And if that's not enough, then that's not who you want to be with anyways. That's my understanding that I've come to. And as Elisa said, I've the same thing. I'm trying to very much embody what I've learned and let that example be. And to truly, when I do see things, especially when it comes to religion and all these other ideas of what's real and who's in charge and who has the power, to question it. Always question it, because it doesn't come from anywhere but in here for anyone. Like, we are projecting our reality. However we assume that happens is whatever name you want to put on it. So, yeah, just try to turn them back to their own self. Not even to me. Not like question what I'm saying too. Not I know everything, but what do you know? How do you feel? How does it feel inside you? How does it feel when you say that? What is it? And help them start to understand what it feels like in them. If they're talking about someone in a negative or hurtful way, then maybe that's the guide right there, that they should be aware of what they're saying or how they feel. So
it can backfire on you, though, because you can have that conversation where they're like, well, are you sure you know? Like, do you have all the information? But it's beautiful to watch, because you at least know that they're going somewhere with it. So it can backfire, because there are many conversations where you have to admit that you don't know everything.
Oh, and then to hear them use my words on other kids, too, is quite interesting. I'm just like, yeah.
But I think you're talking, too, there, you know, codependency, I think, is a strong subject matter in this, where it's like, oh, I have to be, you have to be my happiness, you have to be my salvation, you have to be my information, you have to be my security, and that you're really talking about the antithesis of that, is saying, I've got to show up. If I'm going to show up in a relationship, I'm going to show up in a context, I've got to make sure that I can show up, you know, grounded enough to hold my space and extend that space for others without, you know, invading that.
Yes. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't have kids, but in observing the way most people are with their kids, the conclusion that I've come to is that it's really important that to not tell them that something's good or bad. To look at it in a sense of, like, for example, anger. If you look at it in a sense that it's a tool and it has an appropriate place at certain times, like, there have been times in my life where anger's gotten me out of a real jam, but it's inappropriate in other places. And it's not good and it's not bad. But everyone's so obsessed with the event of something rather than the process of it. Where if you look at, you know, a supernova, if you really look at it closely, there's a lot of stuff going on before it ever gets to that. But most people don't see that. They just want to see the event of it.
and whether it's good or bad.
Looks like he's ready to...
Yep, you're ready. He's cutting us off.